Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Oxford researcher Kate Ollie joins me to talk about Sansa. This chapter is just packed with metaphor and symbolism, and it's a tight little hopeful unit. I love the way the Hound is portrayed in this chapter. I love the foreshadowing. In fact, Kate and I do a little bit of theory crafting on maybe how the Hound will eventually die. Then my friend Arthur jumps on for a short excerpt to talk about unsavory rumors of great women. Because as we all know, Arthur is an insufferable gossip. All right, so without further ado, here is medieval historian Catherine Ollie. I feel like talking with you about Sansa, it is always nice to have someone who really likes the character.
Yeah, I think it does make a difference with how you connect with different characters. I mean, I was chatting with a friend about kind of the series, and I think it was about the series, and they were sort of saying, you know, it's hard to root for anyone because, you know, they're all so terrible. Right. And I feel Sansa just really bucks that trend. Uh-huh. I think it's one of the reasons why she is one of my favorites, because, I mean, even Arya gets a little bit sociopathic at times, you know.
She's got death religion, and,
I really like Sansa, that amidst all of Martin's other kind of characters who are, you know, often scheming and have their own agendas, like, there's a certain, I don't know, integrity about Sansa that I do enjoy.
Yeah. Okay, so I thought this was a lovely chapter. It's such a hopeful chapter, and you get to see Sandor Clegane in kind of an odd light, and you get to sort of see Sansa's hopes get pinned on someone that looks a little bit like the storybooks that she used to read. And I think as a contained unit, it's a very hopeful and really kind of beautiful little chapter.
Yeah, I would agree. I really like this chapter with Sansa, and I really like Sansa's kind of perspective generally. Although it did strike me as I was reading it that a suitable subtitle for this chapter would be Sansa Encounters Drunk Men, basically. Because it's just her wandering around the Red Keep and bumping into people in various states of inebriation.
That's right.
But yeah, no, I love how she, even at this point, she's really kept a kind of core of innocence and goodness about her that we get to see in this chapter.
I agree. And, you know, if you just kind of like can put it out of your mind that, you know, this kind of goes wrong for her eventually, but I kind of love the difference, seemingly difference between, like, Dantos doesn't quite look like the true knight that she was hoping for, but then she can kind of squint and think, well, maybe he does. And then, you know, the Hound absolutely does not look like the true knight she was hoping for, but maybe there are a few hints that he is. So yes, but you're right. They are all drunk. It's after hours in King's Landing. What else is there to do?
Yeah.
So let me go ahead and read my synopsis here. Sansa has been given a secret note. It reads, "Come to the Godswood tonight if you want to go home." After a disturbance outside the castle gates, she makes her way out of Maegor's holdfast and into the night. Sir Dantos, who seemingly wrote the note, is waiting for her. He swears an oath to help her get her back to Winterfell, and Sansa reluctantly accepts. On the way back to her room, a drunken Sandor Clegane interrogates her, belittles her, but then brings her back to her room unscathed. So, Kate, Ollie, what shall we talk about?
Oh, well, there's so much to talk about here. I think, as I said, I really like Sansa, and I like the way in which Martin uses her to play with these stereotypes about kind of chivalry and what it means to be a knight and what it means to be, you know, a medieval lady. And this is a great chapter for that, because we see, these very different kind of models of, knightly behavior, as it were. So, you know, she interacts with Ser Dantos, who used to be a knight and now isn't, but talks a lot in the chapter about how, you know, she has you know, she's kind of made his vows real to him again. And when he was a knight, he wasn't really honorable, but now that he's a fool, he thinks he can be a true knight.
Yeah.
And so I think there's some really great kind of stuff to explore there. Particularly since, and I think I didn't really pick up on this when I read it the first time. You kind of, you know, Sedontos, you pity him and you think he is quite a helpful character for Sansa. But looking back, a lot of what he says is just complete lies, because he's in the pay of Littlefinger all along. And
Yeah.
I don't think I fully grasped how ironic, I suppose, a lot of this chapter actually turns out to be.
Yeah, you don't, if you can kind of just keep it as an isolated unit, it really does raise your hopes, you know, and you know, she's in an impossible situation. She's being abused. You know, she reflects on this bruise that used to be purple and it's turned yellow. Because she spoke out of turn at one point or something, and Joffrey didn't like it. And so she's, yeah, you just want her, you desperately want her to just get the hell out any way possible. And here's this little lifeline that comes along. And she reflects on it. She thinks, you know, this is crazy. I can't believe this. How can I put my life in the hands of this drunken fool? And yet she also thinks, yeah, but the stories that I've read do talk about men of unlikely origin, unlikely stature, unlikely, you know, beginnings, who can find courage and end up acting in knightly ways. And she's able to use that to kind of see beyond the surface. Of course, with Martin, there's never ever two layers. You know, there's always like 14 layers. So, you know, maybe Dantos does believe what he's saying. Maybe he does think that he's acting in her best interest and he's playing his part as he says. But of course, you know, there's also Littlefinger is ultimately behind him, and Littlefinger is a untrustworthy character, I suppose. When you read this chapter, do you feel like you're reading, you know, believably reading a teenage girl? Or do you just. Let's talk a little bit about Sansa in general, shall we?
I mean, I always do find her quite believable. I mean, insofar as, you know, obviously it's all fiction. But I like the way I think Sansa is believably vulnerable, and naive. I mean, even here where, you know, she's lost some of her illusions about Joffrey and, you know, her safety. The bit where she's kind of musing on the situation in the capital, and she thinks a bit about kind of Stannis and Renly, you know, coming to besiege the city. And she doesn't seem to have grasped that they're very separate armies, and that there's a whole load of political stuff going on there. She sort of thinks of them as, you know, they're not Lannisters, and as if this is a kind of, you know, us versus them conflict. And in her head, it just seems quite, I don't know, black and white, that she sort of boils everything down to, you know, the Lannisters and people who are not the Lannisters, and doesn't understand that, you know, just because they have a common enemy, it doesn't mean everyone's going to unite against the Lannisters, and it's actually not going to help her all that much. I think similarly, when the city's kind of under siege, and obviously she's, you know, she's really hoping that Stannis will win, and then Cersei, I think, points out to her that, you know, that's not necessarily going to be
A
the
good thing.
safest option for her.
Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
there's still going to be a lot of downsides, and, you know, she's going to be in considerable danger if the city falls. And again, she hasn't, I think, fully sort of thought that through. And she has such faith in Rob, which is quite tragic when you think about it, because he's always making these political decisions and about how essentially his sisters aren't really worth trading Jaime Lannister for. And, you know, it's always Catelyn pushing Rob to remember his sisters and trying to get them back, and Rob's making the more grown up decision that, you know, you can't trade for two, you know, teenage girls. It's not, his bannerman won't let him. But again, Sansa doesn't seem to realize that she really pins all of her hopes for rescue on Rob.
The other thing about the sort of her calculation with this is that immediately she receives this note. It's under her, you know, it's on parchment. It's in a hand that she doesn't recognize. It's under her pillow. It's a simple one-line note. And her immediate inclination is, I should give this to Cersei.
Yes.
You know, she's sort of working this through in her mind. She's thinking, maybe I should give this to the queen to prove that I can be trusted or to prove that I can be a good girl or something like that. I mean, it immediately kind of homes in on this captor mentality, or almost, you know, she's been abused. She almost has the mentality of a victim and someone who's a bit institutionalized at this point. Like, whatever I can do to avoid the next beating is what I need to do. It's like everything is survival mode. And you almost get a little bit of a, you know, this is kind of the role that Theon ends up playing with Ramsay later on. It's almost like he wants to cast off any desire to have his own agency so that he can simply survive.
Yes.
And so it's a fleeting thought, but it's there, you know. It's all, you know, should I give this to Cersei? Maybe this will prove that I'm good in her eyes. Almost thinking like this could happen, you know, that Cersei could be persuaded as such. And of course, we know that, you know, this is not, you know, anyway, I just don't think Cersei's going to be fooled by any of that. But
no, but I think it's really interesting to look, yeah, at the kind of assumptions that she makes, you know, firstly, that this might be a trap, but also I think she seems to immediately assume that it's from a man, that it's going to be. Could this be her answer at last, a true knight sent to save her? And she kind of runs through possible people in her head, and they're all male, which I also find really interesting.
Yeah, but she thinks, maybe I'll show up to the Godswood, ill and pain will be there with the sword, and he'll be smirking, or maybe this, you know, this is all meant to be Joffrey's trick. Every possibility she can think of, but she takes the risk eventually.
She decides, she does.
I'm going to do this because if I don't do this, I'm going to be here forever. This is maybe my only chance. I noted that Cersei is swapping out servants.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about this. So every 14 days, Cersei decides that she's going to introduce a new set of servants to Sansa's care, so that she will not make any strong relationships with the serving class at King's Landing. And I wanted to ask you about sort of the realities of sort of highborn ladies becoming fast friends with their, you know, their maid servants or something like that. Would this be a sort of a typical upstairs, downstairs sort of thing where you have some sort of work relationship, but sort of it develops into a relationship that really is more of like a friendship, despite the class difference?
So I don't know historically, but I think certainly it becomes a bit of a literary motif sometimes. So I'm thinking of Isolde or Isolde, like she has her nurse or her kind of maid. And she's very involved, obviously, in how Tristan and Isolde originally kind of fall in love with the love potion and everything. And so I think in the literature, yes, this kind of figure of the lady's companion or the lady's maid is, you know, is quite an established figure as someone that she can take into her confidence. And I think there would have been certainly sometimes quite strong bonds. There's a great Icelandic saga where the female character is pregnant and she's traveling to see her brother, who she's not kind of seen in a while, and she's not very happy in her marriage, and she stays with her brother for quite a long time, longer than she intends, because he wants her to stay. And while she's there, her nurse, a woman called Thordis, dies, and she's really distressed by this. You know, the saga sort of says, you know, this really affected her deeply. And so it seems, and indeed it's kind of a bit of a bad omen, because then she goes on to die in childbirth. And it does seem like, you know, losing her nurse is a huge emotional blow for her, because this is a woman who, you know, took care of her and maybe presumably would have helped to take care of her while she was giving birth as well. But those are all literary examples.
And I was also thinking of, like, again, a literary example, but you have the Frodo and Sam relationship, right? And they become sort of, you know, traveling companions and then eventually, you know, war companions. And, you know, I think that historically that is actually sort of a reflects on that, I don't know, battle-tested example. In war, they become fast friends, even if back home they have a class distinction or something along those lines. Cersei's really taking care to make sure that Sansa is absolutely isolated. It's not just that she sends Jane Poole away. It's not just that Septa Mordaime's been beheaded. Sansa can't even have someone who brushes her hair that sticks around. She absolutely has no one.
No.
And you really do get the sense that she's utterly alone.
Yes, and I think it's really interesting to see how she does briefly remember Jane in this chapter, and kind of A, regret that she's not with her, but then B, not give too much thought to where Jane actually is. I mean, she sort of puts her in the same category as Septa Mordaime, so maybe she thinks that Jane is dead. But I find that really interesting that she thinks of Jane as Jane pertains to herself. You know, what a comfort it would be if Jane were here. And of course, later, you know, what has happened to Jane is even worse than what has happened to Sansa, because she doesn't have the kind of protection that Sansa's name and her birth affords.
Well, absolutely. And there's a monster in the kingdom even worse than Joffrey, right? And his name's Ramsay. So
here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you. In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
She misses Jane most. She wishes she had someone who could tell her what to do, and that would be SEPTA.
Mm.
And then she kind of runs through the Rolodex, and she's thinking, well, I actually even, it would be nice even to see Aria. Right?
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about her in relationship to Bran, because in the last Bran chapter, he really is sort of pining for the knighthood that could have been. You know, he's seen all these knights at court. And one thing that Ian McInnes mentioned to me was that, you know, we often think of Sansa in terms of sort of being this naive person who's been affected by the chivalric stories that she's reading. Bran is very much the same way. You know, he really would like to, you know, he thinks back to these mythic knights and wants to be like one of them. And you know, his dreams of being a knight have been shattered, but he still kind of allows his mind to wander from time to time and wonders what might have been. Very much a parallel.
And also, I think Robin as well. He's very obsessed with the winged knight, isn't he? And some of the early legends of the Vale. And so I think, again, that's a kind of, I don't know, maybe a way that she, something she and Robin sort of have in common, and a way they can be compared as well.
She takes the knife. I thought that was a brave move. You know, that's sort of like, you know, even though maybe she's not as familiar with weaponry as Arya is, you know, she's been using this knife to, you know, cut apples and whatnot, but she decides she's going to leave the room. She's going to take the knife, and she ends up drawing the knife on Ser Dantos. And I thought, I don't know if that bespeaks courage, but it does feel like she and Arya are not that, you know, they do have some similarities.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know. Would that be considered beyond the gender norms? Beyond the gender expectations?
I feel like knives, because they're such practical utensils, would have been, quite, you know, common, just because that's kind of eating utensil as well. And so I feel like it wouldn't necessarily have been that unusual, maybe in medieval times, because a knife would just be something probably that both genders are quite familiar with, I think, as compared to kind of weaponry specifically. Whereas I think a knife sometimes, like in this context, is a bit more of a tool than a specific weapon.
Sure.
But I also like how she sort of thinks, you know, she's thinking of her wolf as well as she's kind of drawing the knife. And, you know, she's very much, I don't know, acting out the kind of stark stereotype, you know.
Right.
Wolves and weapons. And I think it's really interesting when Lady kind of comes to her mind. It always tells you something about where Sansa is emotionally.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So, all right, so this is interesting to me. She walks into the Godswood and immediately she thinks, you know, she can smell the earth of it. And she thinks, Lady would like it here. And then she thinks about her wolf. And one of the things that she considers, it's a really interesting thing she says. She says, Lady could always smell out the truth. It was kind of curious to me. I thought, I'm not.
You're not convinced.
All right. So it's got to be, I think it's got to be sort of a literary device here. Immediately, what I thought initially was, Lady is sort of connected with the religions of the North, which I think is sort of built a little bit on Druidism and truth and oaks and truth telling and men of truth and men of the oak. These are all kind of overlapping categories. And, you know, so you've got, you know, Ned, who tells the truth and he's a man of honor. Yep. And then I thought, oh no, this is a nice little set of three in this chapter, because she says Lady can smell the truth. She's looking for a true knight.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sandor comes along at the end of the chapter and he says, I always trusted dogs more than knights. A dog will never lie to you.
Yes, yeah. And he even says a dog can smell a lie. So he kind of...
And then that's the third time that that's... So you have this connection between, I don't know, canines and truth. And I think that if you just look at this chapter as a unit, I think that that set of three is supposed to tell us something about Sandor Clegane. So, I don't want to shortchange Dantos here, but did you notice that? I was wondering how you took that.
Yeah, no, I did notice that. And yeah, similarly, I agree. I think it tells you a lot about Sandor, that, you know, the kind of the parallel between dogs and wolves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit earlier on, isn't there, when Lady is killed and Robert says, you know, get her a dog instead, because that's kind of more appropriate to have, you know, she can have a dog. And again, in Feast for Crows, she gets comfort from that old wolfhound that she has for a while in one of the chapters, just kind of accompanying her. And so kind of that is definitely a motif, I think, that runs through. And again, kind of mixing it all together as well, is this idea of singing that gets used a lot by Sandor and a lot by Littlefinger. And it seems to always have a deeper meaning than just singing, right? It's sometimes it has kind of sexual overtones. Sometimes it's about lying. I mean, so I think in an earlier chapter, Littlefinger says to Tyrion something like, I could sing this song to Lysa, you know, if you wanted me to. And so he seems to use singing. And again, obviously, Marillion comes up later in Feast for Crows. And again, kind of singing and lying and obscuring the truth. And so there's a whole kind of complicated nexus, I feel, between kind of truth and lies, Sansa, Sandor, wolves and dogs. And
also, I think at some point, someone says all crows are liars or something. That, again, the connection between birds and lies, right?
And that feeds in as well, because again, on kind of one hand, you have all the imagery that's dogs and wolves and kind of canine, as you said. And then Sansa has a whole extra load of imagery that is all birds. So she's little bird.
That's right.
Her house sigil is a bird. And obviously with Robin, again, he's obsessed with, you know, the young falcon and all of that falcon imagery that comes with the eyrie. So she always seems to be living in kind of a double life, Sansa. She always has kind of, I don't know, two different meanings to almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I think it's a key thing he's setting up in this chapter. Although I did also wonder, because there's a really obvious kind of comparison here between Dantos and Sandor, you know, two different kinds of knights, one the kind of knightly fool, and one that's the sort of the anti-knight, the, you know, knights are killers and it's all the songs are all fake. And then this kind of specter of the true knight and wondering what the true knight is. And I really wonder how Brienne might play into that as well, as the kind of, you know, she's not a knight, but she ends up looking for Sansa. And sometimes a lot of what Sansa prays does tend to come true in the books. So she prays that obviously Sandor's heart will be gentled, you know, when he turns up in her room, and that, you know, this rage would go out of him, which does seem to come true if you believe that he is the gravedigger in Feast for Crows,
right? Interesting.
Where he's kind of laid down that burden of anger and he's become someone else and the hound is dead. And obviously a lot of what she wishes about Jan of Slint, I mean, she wishes in this chapter that the others will get him, which isn't exactly what happens, but obviously he does come to a sticky end.
No, but she also prays in this chapter that the gods will send her a true knight. And it's possible that this... It's like she thinks it's Dantos, but maybe the true knight is Sandor.
Yeah, or even Brienne later on. Like, it's kind of, I think there's definite overtones that Sansa's prayers do have consequences, I think, sometimes. And that, yeah.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I'll read this little part here. She says, "Why do you let people call you a dog? You won't let anyone call you a knight." He says, "I like dogs better than knights. My father's father was a kennel master at the Rock. One autumn year, Lord Tytos came between a lioness and her prey. The lioness didn't give a shit that she was the Lannister's own sigil. Bitch tore my lord's horse and would have done for my lord too. But my grandfather came up with the hounds. Three of her dogs died running her off. My grandfather lost a leg, so Lannister paid him for it with lands and a tower house, and took his son to squire. The three dogs on our banner are the three that died in the yellow autumn of grass. A hound will die for you, but will never lie to you. He'll look you right in the face." He cupped her under the jaw, raising her chin, his fingers pinching her painfully. "And that is more than little birds can do, isn't it?" So there's a bit there. Of course, we have the sort of the backstory of how the Cleganes and the Lannisters came into relationship, right? But I thought it was really interesting. A hound will die for you, but never lie to you. And I think if we're reading this chapter correctly, Sandor, while he doesn't look a true knight, and while he doesn't claim to be a true knight, I think he is the true knight because he is the hound that won't lie to you. And then he says, "But he will die for you." And I'm wondering, Kate, is this foreshadowing? Ooh, will we eventually lose the hound in service to Sansa's cause?
I mean, I think that would certainly be a very fitting, you know, climax to his narrative arc. I could definitely see that happening. Because I think it would be very hard to write a non-tragic ending for Sandor Clegane.
I think there's something here. I think that I don't know what to make of it. But clearly she's the bird. Clearly he's the hound. I mean, there's no disputing that. There's another little hint here that I wanted to point out. This is the second time he saves her from falling.
Yes.
So back in A Game of Thrones, when she first sees Illyn Payne, she's frightened by him. And she kind of like takes a few steps back to like get away from him because he's so scary. And she trips and someone from behind catches her so she doesn't fall. And she thinks, "If you know, I think my dad just caught me." Like she confuses Sandor with her father. And of course, I think sometimes when you have a mistaken identity in these stories, it means something. And she turns, and then of course it's the hound who's even scarier than Illyn Payne or whatever. But she notes that that he kind of catches her gently like her father would have. And then in this chapter, they bump into each other on this winding stairway, and he catches her from falling and kind of makes a joke out of it. Like, "Are you trying to kill us both?"
Yeah.
And so this is the second time that he has sort of played the role of a protector, even though he's a little bit rough and he belittles her and he makes fun of her. And, you know, he's very much a kind of almost scoundrelly kind of guy, right?
Yep.
But I feel like the story's telling us that he is playing the protector of her in some way.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, it's really interesting in the text, you know, she says, "My Florian to Dontos, the gods heard my prayer."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she literally kind of bumps into the hound, you know, lines later.
Yeah.
Right. Which, as you say, it kind of suggests maybe the prayer's been answered in a different way, not as she understands it. I mean, also, I think they have another encounter on top of a tower, don't they, later on in this book, where he again sort of suggests half-jokingly that she might be about to throw herself off.
Right. I was forgot about that. That's right.
Yeah, so I agree. That's a really interesting connection. He's always kind of there to pick her up when... when she's in a, you know, falling in a panic.
In addition to that, he kind of runs a little bit of interference with her lie.
Yeah.
Like immediately, he interrogates her and he says, "What are you doing out?" And she says, "I was in the Godswood praying for my father." And then as they're talking, Boros Blount comes up and says, "What are you doing out, my lady?" And she says, "I was in the Godswood praying for the king." So I think immediately the Hound knows she's lying.
Right? Yeah.
She can't keep her story straight. Now she thinks that she did better the second time.
Yeah.
So immediately the Hound steps in and says, "Well, who could sleep? How did you expect her to sleep with all the racket that's going on around here?" Almost sort of like deflecting what he thinks is a pretty obvious lie. And sort of helping her back to her room unscathed. I think that he does. That's the second time he does that too, because during the name day feast,
she
saves Dantos, and then he backs her up and says, "Everyone knows that if you whatever you sow on your name day, you reap the entire year," which is sort of a lie she just made up. And then of course how does the chapter end? It says, "They're all liars here. And everyone better than you."
Yeah.
So he knows. He knows she's bad at this, and he wants to step in and help her.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting over the course of the books to see her very slowly get slightly better at lying. There's a bit slightly later in this book where after she's been beaten, and it's Tyrion that comes and kind of rescues her, and he suggests letting her stay the night in the Tower of the Hand, but she doesn't want to do that because she's worried she won't be able to get to the Godswood to meet Ser Dontos.
Right.
She won't be able to get home. And she says something like, "If I sleep here, I'll be haunted by all the ghosts of my father's men." And she sort of says it, and he says something like, she doesn't really know if she's lying or not. She's kind of, she's trying to lie because she doesn't want to be there. But actually, as she says it, she sort of thinks that that's possibly true. and Littlefinger's always trying to kind of coach her into being, better at her deceit. And I think, I mean, one of the things, as I said, I really like about Sansa is that she's one of the few characters in Game of Thrones who does have that kind of core of, kind of honorableness, and she's very kind at heart.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a little bit under siege in the books, and it'll be really important, I think, to see whether she can hold on to that or not, really, because there's nothing really bad about her being a bad liar. I mean, I think that's part of why Clegane likes her, even, actually.
Yeah.
He doesn't like lying, and Sansa is such a bad liar that she doesn't lie to him, which I think he would, he would dislike being lied to. it's kind of, Littlefinger really does, assault that core integrity of hers.
Right. Yeah. Littlefinger is almost the anti-Clegane.
Yes. I think she sets them up on a, they are kind of opposite ends of a spectrum. One of them never kind of signaling his help for her, never offering it particularly clearly, and yet doing a lot to actually help her, picking her up and deflecting attention, and the other one constantly signaling that he says he wants to help her, but actually doing a lot more and using her in much more complex ways. So I think they are different. And I think she's still only just beginning to kind of grasp that still, I think.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, they encounter Boros here. The thing that Boros says is that, there are some fools at the gate. They heard Joffrey was feasting, one of his retainers, and they thought they should be feasted too. Now, that's his story, right? But we know that the food supply has been cut off.
Mm.
And so I think what we're meant to see sort of between the lines here is that there are hungry people rioting out there. And this is exactly why Joffrey decides he's going to don his armor for the first time. He wants to go, out and put down, the siege of evil men. In reality, they're just hungry. the Hound kind of sarcastically says, what a brave boy or whatever. But it does sort of set up the writing that will eventually happen in King's Landing.
Yeah, I think it's a definite stoking of the tensions that, you know, she's pretty oblivious to, but for the reader, it's kind of threatening.
That's right. Yeah, and it'll become a major plot point because eventually, you know, the chaos, there's going to be chaos in the city, and the common folk are not going to be on the side of the Lannisters. And they're actually not going to really care who's highborn and who's not, you know, at the very most basic level. They're not having one of their primary needs met. And so all of these niceties kind of get thrown out the window. And Sandor will get a chance to sort of show himself heroic because of it.
Yes. Yeah, it's a really, I mean, I think that's a really great part of A Clash of Kings is the, I don't know, the febrile atmosphere, I suppose, of King's Landing throughout the whole book. Because we spend quite a lot of time there in Clash of Kings, because we're with Tyrion, who's in King's Landing, and we're with Sansa, who's in King's Landing. And I think, you know, Martin does that really well. The smaller consequences, I suppose, of larger wars, that it gradually builds up and builds up until, we get the very dramatic riot scene. I think it's a really interesting thing again in Feast for Crows, that kind of similar tension that you get building in King's Landing.
Yeah.
But with a different kind of focal point this time, more around the religious aspect.
Yeah, King's Landing is like a powder keg ready to blow.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? There's so many factors going into this. So notable introductions. We hear the Clegane's origin story for the first time. Like we find out why they have a dog on their sigil and why they act like the Lannisters, I guess, pets or attack dogs or something like that. We also are introduced to the note for the first time. No notable departures in this chapter, but I did note that in the show, it's a little bit different in that Sansa's going to the Godswood to pray just because, and then Boros kind of like is hiding there and kind of scares her. Or not Boros, but Dantos.
Dantos, yeah.
Yeah, Dantos is there, and he kind of like sneaks up on her in the Godswood, and that's how they encounter. So there's no need for a note. And it happens not at night, but during the day. So I thought that was really interesting, a really interesting little change there, because you don't have kind of the parallel notes between Catelyn in the first book and Sansa in the second book. Mm. You know, you've got that note from Lysa in the first book to Kat.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I think that this is meant to sort of parallel that a little bit, but you don't get that in the show.
And it also removes a little bit of Sansa's agency, doesn't it? Because she does, you know.
Right.
She thinks in her head it might be a plot, it might be a scheme, but she goes anyway in the book and kind of, you know, she, I don't know, takes her courage in hand and is like,
yeah,
let's go.
Yeah, in the book she has to make a decision: am I going to stay or am I going to go? And she, you know, she's got to, you know, take the risk and grab the knife and go and, you know, hold the knife to Dantos and, you know, interrogate him a little bit and make a decision of what I want to do. Yeah, yeah. I think I appreciate the book a little bit better on these points.
Yeah.
I also wanted to point out that in the show, I think that Littlefinger is given one of the Hound's lines. The end of this chapter, the Hound says everyone is a better liar than you. And then, of course, in the show, it's Littlefinger.
But if he's not marrying me...
He'll let you go home. Joffrey's not the sort of boy who gives away his toys. You have a tender heart. Just like your mother did at your age. I can see so much of her in you. She was like a sister to me. For her sake, I'll help get you home.
King's Landing is my home now.
Look around you. We're all liars here. And every one of us is better than you.
There were just a couple of tiny other things. I like the little the appearance of the black cat that I think also has come up in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
just because, again, I think the cat is Balerion the Dreadwright that used to belong to Princess Rhaenys.
I didn't make the connection.
I assume so. I can't remember. I'm sure at some point someone says that she had this black kitten, and the inference is that it kind of the black cat that is really unfriendly that wanders around the castle is this cat that used to be hers.
Right.
And so assuming that is the case, I think that's a really interesting, just a little detail, because again, the specter of the princess that had no protector, you know, that dies being dragged out from under her father's bed, and it's just another little, I know, kind of intertextual comment on Sansa's situation, I suppose, that there's always the specter of these women that have gone before her that have suffered exactly that kind of fate. So I appreciated that little detail.
I'm so glad you pointed that out.
I'm always slightly curious about the actual story of Florian and Jonquil, because lots of songs that get mentioned, we actually find out kind of the general gist of what happens. I mean, we get quite a lot of the Bear and the Maiden Fair.
Right.
In one of the chapters of Storm of Swords, I think, where it gets sung by Olenna Tyrell's fool to cover one of their conversations. And obviously we know what happens in the Reigns of Castamere, but we never actually know the plot of Florian and Jonquil.
No, I did a little bit of research for this because I thought, I wonder if this is actually ever written down, but all we ever get are sort of like just the general plot points.
Relationship kind of idea, yeah.
Yeah.
So I wonder if, you know, it'll ever come up as a kind of plot point again, and we might learn more, because I think it's a really interesting idea. All the little stories within stories I find quite interesting.
Yes, that's right. And it is one of these things that unifies Martin's characters and gives you a sense that these characters are all kind of working with the same limited range of mythologies.
Yes.
You know, because I think Brienne at one point, you know, sort of indicates that she was told these stories. And I think Rob and John used to pretend to be the Dragon Knight and Florian. And of course, we have this with Sansa. And of course, Dantos knows about this. I think, it's just my headcanon here, but I think that a lot of what Dantos says in this chapter has been rehearsed with Littlefinger.
I was wondering that when I was rereading it, and I was thinking about...
It's a little bit too eloquent.
It's how perfect, yes.
And it's like, when I was a knight, I was a fool, but now that I'm a fool, I feel like I can be a true knight. I think this is like Littlefinger coaching him to say just the right thing and to mention that he could be her... Florian, Littlefinger knows that she's been raised on these stories. And, you know, at one point he tells her, like, life is not a song or whatever. But Littlefinger knows this about Sansa. He knows that, like, where her weakness is. And I think that he coaches Dantos. It's almost just too perfect.
Yeah, I agree that he knows exactly how to kind of appeal to her. Yeah, her sense of what is believable and what is proper and appropriate to the situation. Because it strikes me the bit where she kind of kisses him on the cheek at the end is so performative. Like she feels like this is what the lady would do now in the song. You know, she would give him a kiss, and she feels so like she's acting in a role at that moment.
That
there's nothing kind of emotional about it. It is kind of a social ritualized display. So I agree. I think that's a very believable headcanon to me.
Right.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne. And Sansa almost gets killed.
Right.
But the Hound saves Sansa.
He disembowels that guy.
This guy he enters that room and he like lifts the guy off the ground with one hand.
Yeah.
I always think that always takes me out of the scene. I always think that's Darth Vader.
There is an element of like, I mean,
I don't care how strong you are and how weak the other little person is, to hold someone up with one arm like that.
Interesting.
You only ever see that in the movies.
Interesting, as opposed to smoke babies.
Smoke babies at the right hour of the night, depending on whether I've watched a scary movie.
Seems plausible.
I have a different relationship to the idea of smoke babies.
You feel like you've probably encountered more potential smoke babies than someone who can lift another person up with one arm.
Yeah, no, I feel like I'm watching an A-Team episode when I see that kind of thing.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Something really funny in this book that they talk about the lady of Bear Island, Lady Momo.
Yes.
And then he says that she sleeps with bats.
Yeah, right.
Which I don't know if Martin probably knows this, but this is incredibly historically accurate because almost every single powerful woman in history has had an craziest amount of sexual slander that you literally can't imagine that people would believe this. So yeah. I've put together a short list of a few very famous female rulers and leaders in history, and then we're going to go through.
I love it. I love it.
Completely ridiculous slander about all, of course, of sexual nature. So I'm going to start with Hatshepsut, which is probably one of the ones that you're not going to know. And because Hatshepsut had a low-born advisor that rose to power when she was in control, which of course was true of a lot of leaders throughout history, what'd they say? What do you think they said?
I mean, the most typical one is she sleeps with a horse. I'm just going to throw that out there because that's the one I've heard in the past, but I don't know. Why don't you inform me?
So Hatshepsut, they said that she slept with that lowborn advisor. But I think you're thinking of Catherine the Great, that was, as historians say, a serial monogamist. So she slept with a lot of men, not at the same time, but she had quite a few relationships, about 22, we think. And yes, she died of a stroke, but they claim she died having sex with a horse. It killed her.
It's one of the oldest tropes. Yes.
It's
okay. All right. Let's hear the next one.
This is a Wu Zhao, or Wu Zuqian, as she's known by many people. And so they say that she would seduce lonely peasants to have sex with them. That she was more lustful than prostitutes, and that what she would do is goad lovers to the extreme until they became withered husks, draining themselves for her. And they were left without any maleness anymore.
Oh.
They also claim that diplomats had to perform cunnilingus in order to be able to talk to her. I mean, and every single one of these things, why are these women sexualized?
Yep.
And every single historian will tell you, well, actually what happens is in the following years, after they've had all this power, people really want to bring them down. Mm-hmm. And so they'll create stories about how they fucked a horse.
Yeah.
They'll create a story about the fact that they wore some pants made to have sex with women, or whether they fucked their advisor, or that it kind of brought down the idea that women could have power.
It's a really low imagination. I mean, it's one of these things, it's funny, it's like, how do these slanders end up keep working over and over again when it's such a predictable playbook, right? Now, it's interesting that you bring up Lord Mormont. In this case, you know, the confusion here is maybe it's, you know, Lady Mormont, which is not the young girl we meet in the show, but an older woman. And the rumor is she has sex with the bear. I had a guest on recently that says, actually, that is a true statement, and that woman is actually having an affair with J.R. Mormont, who is called the Old Bear. And so she is sleeping with a relative, and that's where you get the accusation of bear love.
See. Do you think that's what James Slint is
saying? I don't know. I think it's just become a rumor, right? It's just become a rumor. But
maybe Chinese whispers.
But there is sort of a hint there that maybe J.R. Mormont has not kept his vows as Lord Commander. I don't know. It seems spurious to me. But I thought that was an interesting little detail.